This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, January 18th, 2019. I'm Caleb Brown. In 1949, four young black men were wrongfully accused of rape in Florida. The case of the Groveland Four remains a powerful object lesson in systemic racism and white supremacy. And even though all four of those men are now dead, the state of Florida last week finally pardoned them. It's a bittersweet ending to a story chronicled in Gilbert King's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Devil in the Grove, Thurgood Marshall, The Groveland Boys, and the Dawn of a New America. I spoke with Gilbert King this week.
I think for people who are 40 and under, maybe 50 and under, they're aware of the career of Thurgood Marshall on the U.S. Supreme Court and really not much else.
Right.
So part of the events that sort of led up to him becoming such a notable figure within the law, what was his project aimed at generally in the decades in which he was doing all these civil rights cases?
Yeah, and I think that that was one of the things that was most interesting to me because I wasn't really fully aware. I knew he was I knew Thurgood Marshall was the first African-American Supreme Court justice, and I knew he was involved in these landmark civil rights cases along the lines of, you know, Brown versus Board, the school cases, the housing cases, the voting rights cases. But I guess I really wasn't fully aware that he was getting involved in these death penalty cases, these small cases that started in these very small southern cities and towns where, you know, it was just really him or maybe him and a partner showing up and being just the last line of defense in some of these important death penalty cases. And so that was quite a surprise to me. And, you know, he was known as Mr. Civil Rights, but, you know, he was really a hero to a lot of these communities that just, you know, they would usually get court appointed attorneys who were basically, you know, white businessmen or white lawyers in town who had business interests. They weren't so necessarily skilled at 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment law, whereas Thurgood Marshall and his lawyers, that's all they did. And so it was really, I think, quite a surprise to see how involved he was in the criminal justice system back in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s.
And I can imagine after a certain point, the prospect of having someone like a Thurgood Marshall and his team that are practicing these kinds of cases all the time come into your area might have well affected how trials proceeded that he never touched.
Right. And I think that's a really good way to look at it. And for Marshall himself, you know, he knew he was going to lose a lot of these cases because, you know, the odds were just so stacked against him in these local trials that, you know, it was really just came down to 12 white jurors doing what the prosecution asked of them, of him. And so Marshall knew he was going to lose, but his way of thinking in these type of cases, if they were important enough to get involved in, if he could somehow appeal these and possibly get them before the U.S. Supreme Court, that was a more level playing field for him.
Who was Sheriff Willis McCall?
Well, Sheriff Willis McCall was, you know, he had a long reign, 28-year reign in Central Florida in a county called Lake County. He was really basically put into office by some wealthy citrus barons who really just wanted a law and order sheriff to sort of, you know, crack down on union activity and just sort of keep blacks in line in the citrus groves. And that's how he really came into office. He had a lot of experience in agriculture at the time. But basically he became a man who just really, I don't have to describe it, but he went far beyond the citrus interests. He was basically at the head of the Ku Klux Klan in this area. And so his main job just became about racial suppression and white supremacy. And that's what he really enforced for, you know, 28 years. He was a very violent sheriff who got away with things time and time again. He was basically a Teflon sheriff. And mostly it was because the government, from the state attorney to the judge to the U.S. attorneys to the governors themselves, always had Willis McCall's back. And so he really had a powerful reign in Lake County.
So Willis McCall arrests four young men after an accusation, I suppose not even really an accusation, but a claim of rape by a 17-year-old girl. And so he arrests these four young men. How did that trial proceed? And at what point did Thurgood Marshall get involved?
Well, what happened was, as soon as the arrests were made, you had, you know, the Ku Klux Klan was just storming into this area, and they were burning down black homes, and it became so bad that the National Guard had to be called out. And so what happened was they moved very quickly in the Jim Crow South from arrest to trial. They gave these men about a month to prepare for trial, and that was the start of the trial. And Marshall had sent down some, you know, associates from the National Association for the Advancement of Black People, sorry, NAACP. I'm getting confused because there was an organization that formed in Lake County called the NAAWP, National Association for the Advancement of White People, and it was a white supremacy group. And so those are the groups that Marshall was dealing with at the time. But he let down lawyers from the NAACP to defend these African Americans in Groveland. And it was a travesty of justice. The trial was so bad. Witnesses were perjuring themselves left and right. You had fabrication of evidence. You had witnesses being hid from the defense. And whenever Marshall and his lawyers tried to subpoena certain documents that might, you know, be exculpatory evidence, the judge would just quash it.
And the blacks excluded from the jury?
Right. And so the doctor had a medical report that he filed. He found no evidence of sexual assault. And so the prosecution just hid that doctor from the defense, and the judge refused to allow that report to come into evidence. I mean, so that was what Marshall and his lawyers were up against at the time. And later on, it was reversed by the U.S. Supreme Court, and Justice Robert Jackson wrote the opinion. He said, this case presents one of the best examples of one of the worst menaces to American justice.
So here we are decades later. This alleged incident occurred in 1949, and here we are many decades later, and these four young men have been pardoned. But of course, a lot has happened between then and now.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I think that's remarkable is that 70 years ago, this young woman, Norma Padgett, showed up in courtroom and she identified the Groveland boys as her attackers. And Marshall and his lawyers basically just said, that's the trial. It's over now. That was all you really needed. The evidence wasn't even important. Just those accusations of a white woman in court making those claims and identifying her attackers was enough. And I think 70 years later, remarkably, Norma Padgett showed up. She hadn't spoken in seven decades, and she showed up to that hearing room in Tallahassee and basically stuck to her story and said that she was against the pardons. But a lot had changed. Her words didn't carry the kind of weight that they did 70 years ago in Lake County, Florida. Now there was a lot more evidence that I was able to turn up by filing Freedom of Information Act requests. And that evidence was pretty powerful and showed all the perjury and all the evidence that was missing during the trial. And so that was really enough, I think, for the clemency board to say that these men should be pardoned.
How does it feel to know that this has occurred? I mean, if you go through your book, Devil in the Grove, it's, you know, a horrific story. And it seems sort of, I don't know, ineffectual that this pardon is occurring. I suppose, at least a recognition. How does it feel?
Yeah, I think that's the thing. You know, is a pardon enough? You know, these guys are all dead. What does a pardon mean? And I thought about that a lot, and I definitely understand that argument. I could only tell you that, you know, having spent so much time with the Groveland families over the years, to them, it's just sort of a recognition that the state was wrong and that, you know, they were getting gaslighted in the official version. The official version has always lingered that these men were rapists and that one evening they tried to attack the sheriff and he was forced to defend himself and kill them. When in truth, the reality of it is these men were totally innocent and the sheriff committed cold-blooded murder. It wasn't an escape attempt. He tried to kill them because he didn't like the fact that they had got good retrial. And so to me, if the families are satisfied and they feel like this brings them some relief and just recognition that, you know, their official story was wrong the whole time, then to me, that I'm just very satisfied by that.
What changes in having this story out there and appreciated by the public? Obviously, the book won a Pulitzer Prize, but what does it mean to have this kind of story told?
I think what's really important, and this is one of the things that I tried to, you know, really be aware of while I was working on it, because honestly, I didn't know all of this, and a lot of this was new to me. I really could not believe the level of participation and enabling that the government was doing in order to secure and maintain this hold of white supremacy in this particular part of Florida. I originally started out thinking, all right, this is a story of a really bad sheriff. But the further and further I got into it, when I saw that, you know, the governor was complicit, the U.S. attorney was a white supremacist himself, and he was making rulings involving this case, sort of ordering the FBI not to do further investigations, I couldn't believe some of the things I was seeing. And it went right up to the governor, just sort of having Willis McCall's back. That to me was the most disturbing part of the entire investigation that I did.
You wouldn't call it a conspiracy necessarily, but it was a conspiracy to maintain violations of rights on a systemic basis for particular groups of people.
It really was a conspiracy, and that's the thing that's hard to imagine. Like just the level of duplicity. I had gotten a letter fairly recently from the grandson of the prosecutor, and he basically told me, he said, we all knew in the family that these claims of rape were not accurate, but this was the mask that had to be worn in order to be a state attorney in this part of Florida. And he even said that the judge was aware too that these claims were false, and yet they went through with the entire thing. Now, fortunately, that state attorney, towards the end of his life, when Walter Irvin, one of the defendants, was about to go to the electric chair, he wrote a letter to the governor sort of recommending that that Walter Irvin be spared from the electric chair because he had doubts about his guilt. That's as far as he was going. But he did write that letter, which is an unusual thing for a state attorney to just come out and basically say, I got the facts wrong of the case.
So what changed to make this exoneration occur?
That's probably a series of steps. I think one of the most important things was just awareness. The book got a lot of attention and people started to look at it. One of the things that I think was really important was that there was a student at the University of Florida named Josh Venkataraman, and he was reading the book in his history class, and he decided he was going to start a petition. And he did. He got thousands of signatures, and then he went to his local representatives down in Broward County and basically convinced them that they should do something about this. And so Representative Bobby DeBose and Senator Gary Farmer got together and co-sponsored a bill. This is about 2 years ago, and brought it to the floor of the Florida State Legislature and apologized to the Groveland family and recommended that they be put forth towards exoneration by the Clemency Board. So it was really, I think, a grassroots sort of activism that really inspired this. It was just a young 21-year-old kid who's reading this in his history class, and he was really the one that started it all.
We glossed over, really, the fact that Sheriff McCall killed some of these young men. He was cleared of any wrongdoing.
Right.
What did his career look like after 1951?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that was a major happening. Like on the evening of the retrial, the sheriff shoots two of the defendants in a car claiming that they tried to escape. One of them died instantly. The other one survived by playing dead because he was handcuffed to his best friend. If he had died that night, I don't think this case – I definitely couldn't have written this book. I mean, that would have been the end of this case. The fact that he lived – and there was a forensic investigation into that shooting that sort of proved to the FBI that Willis McCall had committed this in cold-blooded murder. That was really the thing that got this case off the ground and made it a national story at the time, even though it was forgotten quickly. So that was that catalyst in the whole thing, just surviving that execution. It was sort of almost like having cell phone footage of a murder. It was proof that people now were able to say that perhaps the sheriff is a cold-blooded murderer.
Gilbert King is author of Devil in the Grove, Thurgood Marshall, The Groveland Boys, and The Dawn of a New America. We spoke this week. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast anywhere you get your podcasts, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.